You're listening to the U LaSalle Student Entrepreneurship Podcast. I'm your host, Jay Abubo, giving you your insider's guide into the lives of our students, alumni, and other high-impact innovators of the University of Utah campus, our Utah community, and our world. Today, I am sitting with Mark Pittman from Blinksy. He is the founder and CEO of a company that has acquired $2.6 million in venture capitalist funding. Mark, welcome to U LaSalle Student Entrepreneurship.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. So Mark, when I had first met you, you shared with me that you had grown up in Europe and spent much of your formative years living in Germany. Additionally, you told me how your mother had taught you how to treat the world like a big sandbox. Could you share with our listeners how that formative philosophical groundwork laid the way to how you view the world today?
So for me, growing up in Europe was a really interesting experience. I got to test out different cultures and different ideas the same way we travel between states. Europeans travel between countries. So I had the opportunity to experience different cultures, different languages, and different ways of life. When I moved to the States when I was about 14 through the army, I got to then experience Western Utah culture. And I also got to see the differences between sort of social policies and the way people go about their lives. And for me, having grown up in Europe from a mother who was German and a family who was German, I got to experience the differences between a sort of post-war Europe mentality and a Western American mentality. And that melded together this really nice sort of social policy, if you will, that I have in my mind of improving the world through capitalism and innovating, if you will, and using business as the tool to change the way we live our lives.
How have you noticed that U.S. mentality versus the European mentality is different with regards to our histories with war?
So the biggest difference is that Europeans work to live and Americans live to work. I mean, something we hear talked about all the time. Europeans value life in a different way than we do. We are much more about things and they are much more about experiences. It also has in large part to do with the fact that resources are more scarce. There are more people and there is less space. And so people make do with smaller apartments, with fewer cars, and they value different things than we do. So I think that's one of the biggest experiences and biggest differentiators. They also remember and see the scars of war aggressively. I mean, outside of September 11th, we don't really see representations of war inside of our country, right? I mean, you walk up to the 9/11 memorial and you can see the scar that was left in our country. In Europe, the scars are still everywhere and they're prominently featured. So people are reminded much more aggressively of the value of life, I think, in some ways than we see it here. And oftentimes I feel like we take it for granted. And I think those are the biggest differences.
Yeah, I think about how I had watched that documentary by Michael Moore called Where to Invade Next. And in it, he showed how children in Germany were learning about World War II as a part of an empathy building exercise that's built into the curriculum. And how even within the infrastructure of the city, you walk around and you're faced with those reminders every day. Whereas in the U.S., we don't quite have that to the point where the way that it comes visible is through movements like Black Lives Matter. What thoughts do you have about what the U.S. could do about shifting that perception in the way that you've learned to value it?
I mean, the biggest differences that we've seen, and you've also heard older generations talk about differences, for example, during the draft. When the draft was instituted, it forced people to connect with other members of their country, right? We moved people from Utah to Georgia and to New York City and to California in a way that they normally wouldn't do or go. Initiatives like the Peace Corps or participating in the Red Cross are also really good at doing that. I think one of the biggest things the United States needs to do is we need to have much more outreach with other countries. Europeans are very aggressive at sending their children to the States for periods of time to study, to learn, go to school. I mean, whatever the initiative is, just immersion. I think that's something we don't do very well and we need to get better at. Rather than just being a vacation destination, going to Europe needs to be a learning institution and an integral part of maturing and coming of age. Of course, it's expensive. Government can help and support in ways that introduced funding, and the State Department's very actively involved in those sorts of initiatives. I think the impact on someone's life is very, very prominent in ways like that. And you can actually see that in Utah, in particular with the LDS Church and with missionaries. They see and experience other cultures. They have a higher cultural identity. And I think many missionaries come back from foreign countries with a love for their adopted country, if you will. And I think that's something that all Americans could really enjoy and benefit from.
That certainly lays the groundwork to what has philosophically informed your making of Blinksy, that being a big data company that has interconnected the world and has given us very keen insights into the traffic of the given area of your clients. But we'll build up to that point. In 2004, you earned an Eagle Scout Award through the Boy Scouts of America. How did being a Boy Scout in your fundamental years teach you values that you carry into your work today?
Yeah, so being a Boy Scout was sort of the first experience I had in taking sort of personal responsibility in both my community and growing something. So growing an organization, being responsible for a project, in particular an Eagle Scout project, and one that contributes to the community was incredibly important. And that's the first time that I learned to do that and was sort of in a setting and environment to do that. It was also the first time that I had to interact with a sort of government official, if you will. So I did my Eagle Scout project at a high school. I had to reach out to the principal and see if they could give us access to the building. And we cleaned up sort of the courtyards and the picnic tables and those sorts of things for my project. So I had to, for the first time, sort of reach out on my own, sort of cold call, if you will, someone and solicit them to do something that I wanted them to do and convince them to do that.
Being an Eagle Scout taught you about sales.
Absolutely. No, sales, sort of responsibility, work ethic, you're sort of responsible for the entire project. The most important lesson it started teaching me was how to work with a team and how to lead a team. The most difficult thing I do today still is motivating my team, focusing my team, recruiting my team, and growing my team.
Demonstrating your ongoing commitment to public service, what else were you interested in during high school that informed your academic direction in undergrad?
So, I mean, the biggest influencing factor for me has always been my family history. My grandfather survived the Second World War. My great-grandfather died in the front lines. My great-great-great-grandfather starved to death so that his grandchildren could make it to Germany. They were then in Poland. My dad was in Iraq. My brother-in-law was in Afghanistan. My family has been influenced by war and by government policy in an aggressive way. And it's shaped my identity and my resolve to be a part of the conversation when most people who come from the background that I do don't have that voice at any point in their time. I mean, the military recruits very aggressively from military families because they know the system, they know the way, it's a self-perpetuating cycle. It's fairly rare for a military brat like me to sort of get advanced degrees, start a company, be an entrepreneur, and sort of pull away, if you will, from the army recruiting process. Not saying that's a bad thing, but I think it gives me a different view of the world. But I look at that as an opportunity to serve the public in a different way and to eventually help engage in the political process in a way that brings those sorts of identities to the forefront and make sure they're part of the conversation. And in high school, that also sort of informed the path that I was going to take. I was very involved in debate. I was actively involved, of course, on the swim team, a lifelong swimmer, enjoy swimming. And then I also worked on the side. I mean, I came from a background where work ethic was very important, very, very hardworking parents, grandparents. And so in those formative years, I did lots of work.
I always find it particularly inspiring to learn about people's first jobs, speaking of work, way before they became a hotshot entrepreneur who has the capacity and know-how to impart major value into the market and the lives of people in our community. Could you talk more about your first job?
Yeah, so my first job was as a retail associate at a pet store. I worked there for 2.5, almost 3 years, I think, and did everything from cashiering to customer service, taking care of the animals, stocking shelves. It was very, very important for me. It taught me a couple of things. One, it taught me the customer service profession, what it was like to serve a customer. Two, I was in a very fun environment with animals and pets, and that was a really exciting way to learn these valuable lessons because it didn't feel like work, it felt like fun. And it sort of gave me this opportunity to have an experiential learning program, if you will, that I was fortunate to get paid for. So I learned a lot there. I also learned what managers I liked, what I didn't like, what policies, what philosophies I liked and didn't like, And it started to form my view of how I would one day manage a company.
Should everyone do a customer service job before they hit the job market?
I wouldn't disagree with that. I mean, everyone says that about servers in the food industry as well. I've never been a server or never worked in the food industry, but those are definitely two skill sets that help you build empathy with your fellow man, right?
Mark, when I did research on you, I found an exhaustive LinkedIn resume that was filled with your amazing experiences. I scrolled for much longer than I do with many LinkedIn profiles that I connect with. You accomplished a lot, even within your education, where you received a Bachelor of Economics, International Studies, Political Science, and Social and Behavioral Sciences within a 4-year period for your undergraduate education. What motivated you and systemically enabled you within the academic system to be able to accomplish so much as an undergrad?
So I'm a first-generation college graduate. My parents never went to school. Not formally, and I came from a military background. So for me, going to college was a very different experience than for most. The only reason I really went to college, I think, in the end, is because my friends did. It was the next thing to do. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. My dad was in the army, in the military, and so that was sort of the clear path, and the military typically recruits from military families. So for me, it was sort of unusual to go the path that I did in some ways, in large part because the University of Utah came to my high school and talked to us about coming to the University of Utah and gave out fee waivers for my GPA rank so that we could apply to the university. So I was admitted to the University of Utah and looked at a few other schools, but not very many, to be honest, and just sort of ended up at the University of Utah by happenstance. And that led me down a really interesting path. So in particular, I have an affinity for politics and always have, and I took advantage largely of the Hinckley Institute of Politics while I was at the University of Utah and did a series of internships there. And in the process of doing that, became very enamored with the idea of economics and the interplay between the economy and politics. So fortunately, many of the degree requirements for all three of the degrees, undergraduate degrees that I got, count towards one another. So I was able to sort of leverage those. I, of course, took probably many more credits than the average student takes a semester and worked throughout the summer semesters, but was working a full-time job most of the time that I was in my undergraduate and doing a series of internships as well. So for me, it was a focus on accomplishing something I wanted to accomplish, something that was interesting for me. I found a love of learning. I've always had that, an interest in learning more, particularly in reading. And it was through the practical experience that I actually saw the value in doing that. So in being an intern, I actually learned skills in class, was talking about topics in class that translated directly to the work I was doing. So this idea of experiential learning is incredibly important to me because it's the reason that I'm where I am today. And I think it's one of the things the University of Utah does better than the majority of other institutions is we actually connect the lessons you learn in the classroom to the lessons you'll need in the workforce one day. And without that tangible connection, you have no real understanding or reason as to why you would need to understand Pythagorean's theorem or whichever grammar lesson that you're learning that day. So that thing, that's really where it started.
The myth about the humanities is that they're soft skills and degrees that can't land you a real world job upon graduation. I think about you and your involvement with Blinksy. You eventually developed hardware, which takes a lot of engineering savvy. How would you consult a student who chose to study the humanities about this myth?
Look, in the globalized world, specialization is key. Doesn't matter who you are, what you're doing, you have to be really good at what you do, and that can't be everything. I tried to take a scattershot approach for a while and realized I was really good at some things and I needed to get really even better at doing them and hire people to augment the parts that I wasn't great at. So the one soft skill I've learned more than any other is that you hire smart people to do the things you can't do. That's my purpose here at the company in particular. But soft skills, you know, are often sort of lumped together in this one big generic category. But public speaking, the ability to persuade, the ability to write, any of those sorts of skills are very, very key in most of what we do today. People want to interact with human beings, not with robots or machines. You have to be very careful in that process. Emotional intelligence is key to getting the world to do the things you want them to do and to essentially getting along to get something to happen. So those are the soft skills I learned the most, and I think that were incredibly important. Realize that everyone has a place that they fit into, not talking about in the world, but in everything that they're doing, whether it's at home or in their career, in their work. you may be the person who's really good at doing speeches, and that's what you do. You may be the person who's really good at putting together decks. That's what you do. You may be the customer service person. That's what you do. But you can also be the person who's writing code. You can also be the person developing algorithms. You can also be the person doing spreadsheets. There are a variety of skill sets. You need to identify what works best for you and how. That being said, learning to code is key, period, and something I'd encourage everyone to pursue.
Is that something that you pursued during undergrad, or if you didn't, do you regret it?
It's something I didn't do and something I wish I would have done. The knowledge economy was sort of just coming online. The digital economy was just sort of evolving as I was graduating high school. We're in the post-2007 recessionary economy, which also had an impact on that. I didn't think about coding. I didn't have a computer background from that perspective. I think the world today is much different than it was just a few years ago when I graduated from college.
What got you onto the track of Juris Doctor focusing on corporate law and entrepreneurship through the Lausanne Institute? What turned you on to that?
So when I graduated high school in 2007, within 9 months of graduation, the recession hit. When I graduated my undergrad in 2011, we were in the midst of a continued recession, and the economy was in bad shape. So I essentially found myself at the time working at a law firm in downtown Salt Lake City as a sort of law clerk and legal assistant. And I really loved the work I did throughout my entire undergraduate career. And I got turned on to the idea of becoming a lawyer that way. But I didn't love the actual practice of law. And at that time in particular, there were plenty of lawyers and not very many jobs for lawyers. The market was saturated. All of the large law firms in particular who had just come off of the massive boom in the early 2000s were shedding legal jobs like crazy. So the idea of going to law school didn't quite feel right. I also didn't feel like I was quite ready. I had just come back from an international internship experience in Australia, where I'd worked in the sort of state politics, if you will, in the area of Melbourne, and had a phenomenal time there understanding how different cultures sort of think across American policy in particular. But I also started to realize that the one thing that connects everyone is the economy. And that business is core to all of this, that the business of being a lawyer is also a business, that everything is a business, that everything relies on the dollars we create today and the dollars we spend tomorrow. And that's where I really got turned on to the idea of business school. And in the process of doing that, I decided that I was going to apply to law school. So I finished my master's in international affairs and global enterprise. And then I was applying to law school and had already set in my mind that I was going to get my MBA. And that I was going to sort of focus in large part on being a, as the business school likes to call it, an MBA JD rather than a JD MBA. So I got my sort of joint degree, if you will, but with a focus on business and how to apply my legal thinking and my legal knowledge to being a better business person rather than my business thinking on being a better lawyer. And I didn't actually understand that fully until pretty near graduation, to be honest. Because the law school does a really good job of teaching you to want to be a lawyer. And you learn the theory of law and you learn to love the law, and all of your friends want to become lawyers. So you sort of have to defy everyone and everything to not be a practicing lawyer. And I didn't take the bar.
You had to be a rebel and an entrepreneur in that own right.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's exactly correct. And in the process of doing that, you know, I had already started Blinksy. I had been very, very involved with Lausanne, had been running the new venture program up there, had gone to the business school and asked for additional funding for the ambassador program. And generously, Dean Taylor Randall gave us additional funding to help encourage that diversity, in particular first-generation students in college, is a big personal goal of mine to help drive and foster in people. And so I was sort of working towards that and wanted to encourage that. And I think entrepreneurship, in large part, in particular for immigrant families, first-generation college students, is a very, very, very attractive way to make a living.
That's when you were attracted to the Lausanne Ambassador Program and had worked to encourage scholarship funding within low-income communities.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the idea for me really simply was, I think there is no better community than the one that doesn't come from a traditional background of passing on the baton from parent to child, of going to college or the same university and getting the same degree. Lawyers in particular are sort of bad about this. Usually once you have a lawyer in your family, you continue to have a lawyer in your family, it seems. There are those there are those families and those students who never get the opportunity to jump into that cycle. So that cycle is also aggressively changing. Technology, in particular, startup culture, the service economy, and the gigabyte economy are changing the way the world works.
The University of Utah was Blinksea's first big client. In retrospect, what involvements on campus were particularly catalytic in your development of Blinksea or in your development as an individual?
So the university played an important role both in my personal development, but also in the life cycle and the growth of Blinksea. So I was very involved in ASUU in my postgraduate career and got very involved in campus initiatives, whether it was electric vehicle charging stations on campus or water bottle refilling stations. And all of those stemmed from a pain point. I wanted to fill up my water bottle and couldn't, and didn't want to go buy bottled water all the time. The university had to haul out the trash, and I didn't see the logic. So that was something I pursued. And the same thing was true on the electric vehicle front. I was thinking about buying an electric vehicle because gas prices were $5 a gallon, and I wanted a place to charge my car, and they weren't there. The university has been the best partner in every way, shape, and form. You find department heads and university managers who are willing to engage with students to chase down silly ideas and see what comes of them and really engage with you and any other student. And ASU, of course, plays a very formative part in that. We have one of the most active student governments and most important student governments in the sense that they can actually make an impact. So I would encourage students to not only be involved, but then also find other paths. Pursue things and never sort of take no for an answer, if you will. Pursue your passions and find a way to get it done.
I think about the hardware of Blinksea. I had recently had a conversation with a couple of engineers from the Entertainment Arts and Engineering program at the University of Utah. And one of the things that they had told me was there are PhDs that spend their whole education and in many, many years to be able to develop hardware. And they also spend more years in accumulating money and funds only to see their technology be for naught. How did you, as a student at the University of Utah, gain the access to be able to tinker around with hardware that eventually led to the building of Blinksea?
Well, really, I was fortunate to have very smart friends who helped me, and the university gave us access to infrastructure, the resources that it takes to tinker. Think of LaSan Studios in particular, and a co-working space, the ability to thrive and play around with things and experiment. I didn't have that at the time, but there were still plenty of resources on campus to take advantage of. And we also benefited from the fact that in this day and age, you don't have to develop anything from scratch. That's not your position to do, really. It's to find a way to make something work, a minimum viable product, if you will. And there's off-the-shelf hardware that you can sort of combine, commingle, and use software to manipulate. And that's what we were fortunate to be able to do as well.
On the official Blinksea website, it cites its origin as a company with your frustration with a traffic light that would not turn on. Could you share with our listeners that story?
Absolutely. So leaving campus late one night after a study session, I tried to head home and I got stuck at a traffic light that wouldn't turn green. I got frustrated that the light wouldn't turn green and I eventually had to find a different way home. But it got me thinking, why doesn't this traffic light turn green? Why doesn't the traffic light know that I'm there? Should be detecting my car or my phone or the heat from my vehicle, the metal on my vehicle, anything like that. And it wasn't. And that got me thinking, why?
Really though, why?
So essentially the gist was what I found out engaging with Salt Lake City, whose traffic and transportation department in particular has been fantastic and very, very helpful in the development of the company, is that there are sensors that exist today. They're very expensive. They're very cumbersome. They do pieces and they can't really be scaled everywhere given the cost. And I set out to solve that problem initially, and Blinksea morphed out of that idea into the big data company that it is today.
What convinced you that this was an entrepreneurial idea worth pursuing? Did it start out as a business idea to begin with?
So it started out as something I wanted to do for fun. I was fortunate enough to be at the university where the LaSand infrastructure, if you will, the LaSand network had helped in crafting things like the Get Seated program that helped us get a little bit of money to play with this idea to see if it was even viable. And that's really when I started realizing it. But the moment where I understood that this was an idea worth pursuing, that the business became a business, was when we found a customer to pay for it. And our first customer, of course, was also the university.
Who within the faculty or staff at the U was amongst the most influential in Blinksea's development?
So I have to say that, of course, President Pershing has created a culture on campus in which engagement with students is of paramount importance to the staff, but of course it also clearly leads to successes like Blinksy. So there's a reason to do it, and I have to applaud the president for his leadership on that front. But secondarily, I would also say that Gordon Wilson and Jason Perry have been incredibly formative in helping me both get the company running, providing me with support, helping me understand the university system, and then, of course, helping me sell and share my story to other customers.
The University of Utah gives you that real-life experience, and not necessarily to put a plug for the U, but to go into this idea of how it leads to entrepreneurship. What is it about the culture of Salt Lake City, from your point of view and as an entrepreneur, that allows that framework to exist within the University of Utah?
Yeah, so I think it's a couple of things. I mean, one, we're focused on research and innovation, period, right? I mean, look at the medical school in particular. It's a hub of innovation on the medical side, but also we were one of the first nodes on the internet when the internet was first built. I mean, the University of Utah has always sort of been on the cutting edge. We're very fortunate to be in the place that we are. So we're positioned essentially 2 hours from most of everything. I travel often for work, and I'm in Texas often, in California often, Denver, Idaho. You can get almost anywhere within 2 to 3 hours, basically. That puts us in a very unique position, I think. Also, geographically, we're positioned well because of the Wasatch Front. So one of the interesting things about our business is that we've been able to experience the challenges that most areas have within the confines of the Wasatch Front. So essentially, the majority of our population lives on a 100-mile stretch that's about 10 miles wide, nestled between the mountains, of course, and the Salt Lake. And that puts us in an area where we have to think about resources. We have to think about transportation methodologies. We have to essentially move north to south. And there's a very, very finite number of resources available in that space. So I think even for a conservative state, it's made us think more about the environment, about land use policy, about planning. And that's actually made us innovative and entrepreneurial in thinking about those sorts of issues. That in large part reflects on Salt Lake City's culture. We also take advantage of the fact that we are a conservative state. So we're scrappy and we try new things and we're not afraid to take risks. Sort of that Western mentality meets innovative, entrepreneurial, cool environment. And that being said, I mean, Salt Lake City is also a more liberal hotbed for exploration ideas. And I think the University of Utah's position sort of in the trifecta of those concepts puts it in a very unique place. The university, of course, the administration in particular, does a lot to incentivize and create a culture that supports this. I mean, the Lassonde Institute alone is probably the thing that I credit for being where I am today, the single institution that I credit outside of the greater university. And you have to have a support, you have to have leadership that incentivizes, encourages those things to get that to begin with.
You earned your master's in business administration and general management, as well as a Juris Doctor in law at the University of Utah in 2015. Why get your MBA in law degree?
So I worked for lawyers and law firms for about 4 years before I went to law school. And I loved the idea of the practice of law. I knew that I wanted to be involved in it. I knew that politically, it was a very useful skill to have if I one day wanted to pursue a political career. And I also knew that regardless of what I did in the business world, it could come in handy. So I went to law school with the idea that I would get an MBA after my first year. I entered the MBA program as well, and it was probably the most effective combination for me to actually start a company. Initially, you don't have very much money. You're trying to do everything on a shoestring budget. You're also learning a lot. So having the skills, investing in myself was the most important thing I could have done. And the piece of advice I would give to everyone else, an investment in yourself is never a bad investment. Just make sure you understand what the return is going to be.
Did you have an idea of what that return was?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, for me, it was I wanted to do something after law school. Originally, it wasn't supposed to be an entrepreneurial endeavor. I didn't see myself as entrepreneurial. Lawyers are trained to identify risk and run from it, and I dove head on into it. So from that perspective, that's not quite what I was expecting, but I thought I would have a career in which I would be working for large corporations or working in general counsel's office or taking some kind of role where I had to translate business and lawyer speak, if you will, and be very involved in that process. I also had a goal and aspiration to, of course, work into executive management, and went out and saw that there was, I think, 10 or 12% of CEOs on Wall Street or in the Fortune 500 have either law backgrounds or legal backgrounds or have disciplines and skill sets that relate to that.
Were you working on Blinksy at the time that you decided to continue your higher education at the U?
So I started the idea for Blinksy while I was in business and law school.
What student activities were you involved in as a master's student that furthered Blinksy's trajectory to become a viable commercialized project?
I was actively involved in the Lausanne New Venture Development Program, which is really what gave me the skill set and the learning experience to be able to scale the company. I had been working in some way, shape, or form in about 16 different technologies in the 2 years I was in that program, and it gave me the opportunity and the skill set, if you will, the experience to test out ideas, to get a sense of what I should be doing, how I should be doing it, and essentially the credential in some way to just take it on.
What is Blinksy?
So Blinksy collects data on the habits and trends of people as they go about their lives, completely anonymously. And we do this with the vision and for the purpose of driving better government and better decision-making across all of our customers.
Did you know that you wanted it to function the way it does now?
Oh, of course not. It's an iterative process, right? So build, measure, learn. The company was supposed to originally be a concept to make traffic lights go green. And of course, now the company is a big data experience, something more akin to Google than it is to traffic lights. So from that perspective, the company has evolved a lot. And this will happen to every entrepreneur. You'll make little pivots, or if you can even call them pivots, adjustments to your strategy. And eventually you'll look back and say, hey, this looks entirely different than what I thought.
In its original incarnation, Blinksy was actually called Sync. Could you talk a little bit about the evolution of the Blinksy name?
So when I first started the company, I tried to use the name Sync and realized there was a trademark on the word as it related to automotive and transportation initiatives. So we had to come up with a new name, and we essentially took the words Blink, Light, and Sync, which was the original inspiration for the company, and mashed them up into a name, Blinksy.
Blinksy. I like saying it too. In a video called The Conference of Champions that aired on Pac-12 television from spring to summer 2015, you shared during your interview on Blinksy about how you had called the vice president of facilities management at the University of Utah and how they had encouraged you to run a beta test to aggregate traffic data for the U. This was no doubt a huge project for you and Blinksy. Was Blinksy a company by the time that you had presented to facilities management at the U?
Blinksy was a company because of facilities management at the U. They were the reason that we decided, hey, there's a viable market. There's a consumer, a customer who wants a problem solved, and we can solve it for them. So I credit the university in large part to helping us cross that final little chasm to actually starting the company, giving us the why, the reason to actually be a business.
What did you do that helped convince the U to utilize Blinksy's services at that stage of startup development?
The most important thing, period, whether it was our customer, the university, or any other, is start with a problem. Identify a pain point, something that they're having a hard time solving. You're there to make their lives easier. They are your customer. You want them to be your customer. How do you make their lives better? How do you make their lives easier? So that's how we started. We identified a pain point, and we worked from there.
What challenges did you overcome at this point in time that became the level of efficiency that Blinksy operates at today?
Well, one, we didn't have any money, which was an interesting problem to solve. So we built a system, if you will, basically off my credit card, and took a risk. That's how everything starts. You've got to take a risk somewhere. So that was step one. Step two was, of course, getting the manpower to buy in. We couldn't pay anyone, so we had to get people bought in. So those were the most important steps initially, was how do you build critical mass? That's what you've got to get to. You've got to have something that works, that solves your problem, a minimum viable product, and then you can scale from there. So for Blinksy, the first several months were all about the MVP.
Would you mind sharing how much you had maxed out or had spent in order to make your first prototype for Blinksy?
Oh, I'm not exactly sure. It was sort of a mix of things, but I'm sure we spent $3,000 or $4,000.
How did you do that without breaking the bank later?
I took a risk and hoped that it would work out.
2015 was a big year for Blinksy. Patrick Brown joins the company in November 2014 as Chief Technology Officer. His title was made official in January 2015 when Blinksy became a full-fledged company, according to your LinkedIn's. In March of 2015, Blinksy becomes a finalist in the Utah Innovation Awards, presented by Stowell Rives LLP and the Utah Technology Council within the Enterprise Software, Cloud, and big data category. And by June of 2015, Blinksy's next big client was literally a whole city, Park City, Utah, employs Blinksy to aggregate traffic data, firstly with skiing and commerce in mind. Quite the trajectory. Could you share with our listeners what conversations you and Patrick were having in the beginning of 2015 that led to approaching Park City?
So Utah's a very, very small world. And we really got connected with Park City because of our very first investor. So our very first investor, Doug Wells, lives in Park City, was an active member of the community, and happened to hear about some of the problems Park City was having and said, hey, why don't you talk to Blinksy? So that's really how it started and why. So always lean on the relationships and the network that you and your friends have. You'll never know who someone might know. So those are really the critical pieces, I think, for us. But of course, you know, we had to get critical mass somewhere. So we're having lots of conversations in the process of building the business and the sensor technology and how it would work, and then how to actually make it scale. How do we deploy a whole city, for example? So those were really a lot of the pain points we had to tackle. And Park City ultimately took a risk on us the same way the university did, and the same way we took on ourselves. And we thank them for doing that.
What was Park City interested in that you knew Blinksy could help with?
So the biggest problem that we set out to solve was no one actually understood where traffic was going or what it was doing. Where were people coming from? What were they doing? How long was it taking them to get there? What was the travel path, the habits and trends, if you will, of traffic in a city? That's a question that's very important. You've got to determine road capacity, bus planning, parking locations. All of that matters. And if you want to clean up the air, which is an initiative that Park City is, of course, very, very concerned with, then buses and transportation are a key part of that. So that was a core focus for them, and also a way for us to help them solve a problem.
Segueing into venture capital, Blinksy received $2.6 million in seed venture capital from Peterson Ventures and Pelion Venture in January of 2016, this year, not even a year after graduation from your master's education at the U. To be honest, Mark, venture capital sounds super daunting. When did you know that it was time to seek additional funding for Blinksy?
Well, look, so much of venture capital and of startup life is coincidences. We didn't have the capital to grow in business. I had just come out of school, had never had a real career job, if you will, could have never really accumulated any capital or any savings. And the same thing was sort of true for Patrick. We didn't have the money to self-fund this, to grow this ourselves, and we decided to take a risk. And we were fortunate that through the Utah Entrepreneurship Awards, we were able to meet some of the local venture capitalists who got excited about our idea and approached us about the idea of raising capital. Graduation was quickly approaching at the time we first raised our first bit of capital, and I needed to decide what to do. I had an opportunity to potentially pursue a career at other companies, and I needed to decide whether Blinksy was what I was going to do. I needed to be able to pay my bills, and of course, my student loan payments were coming due. So it was a bit of necessity for us, but also we wanted to be a high-growth startup company. We wanted to scale, we wanted to leverage technology, and we wanted to make an impact. And venture capital fit our mold. The why we wanted to grow the company, the why we wanted to do this company, lined up really well with the why that venture capital exists. Venture capital is not for everyone, and everyone should look at it themselves, but we have phenomenal partners. Peterson and Pelion co-led our venture rounds here, and I would highly encourage anyone who's interested in raising money to talk to people before they actually do it. You can even meet the VCs before. They're interested in funding people, less ideas, and they want to fund good people.
What made Blinksy good people?
That's a great question. You'll have to ask our investors if you want to know the answer to that. But I would assume that it was ultimately execution. So the one thing you have to do is you have to do, and there's no one to do it for you. You come into a company, and if it doesn't get done, it's because you didn't do it. So that was one of the biggest factors that VCs look at. They also look at the alignment. We were all in. I turned down other job offers to do this. Patrick turned down other job offers to do this. This was our full-time opportunity. Our skill sets aligned for it. This is what we wanted to do.
What fit were you looking for Blinksy?
So venture capitalists have specialties the same way people do. There are some who invest in healthcare technologies, other that invest only in hardware, some that invest in consumer products. We're fortunate in Utah to have a broad breadth of early stage venture firms who were willing to play with different ideas. Some firms were less interested in Blinksy because of the hardware component initially. Many of them came around to the idea after we started growing. So you've got to find the best partners for you. And they might not even be in Utah. They might be in Chicago, New York, and Philadelphia, or in Silicon Valley. It's up to you to decide that, to determine that. But you do have a choice. Remember that.
How did you know who to approach for venture capital?
I got lucky. Basically, I met the VCs that we have here. There are only a handful of them. We're a fairly small community, and they all know each other. And when one of them is interested in a deal, they want the experience and the feedback of another. So I was fortunate to sort of get passed down a little bit. Also, some of our initial angel investors were very familiar with the venture capital firms. So we got introduced to a host of them that way. And of course, it's good old-fashioned research.
You can just Google venture capitals lists in Utah and it'll pop up.
Exactly.
The Blinksy team rapidly grew from there. By October 2015, it was you, Patrick Brown, as Chief Technology Officer, with Carly McFarland, People and Projects Management, and David Lewis as a software engineer, leading up to the hiring on of Jack Vines, who joined your team as Chief of Strategy in May of 2016. Huge moves for your team within the hiring process. How did you know if interviewees of Blinksy were a correct fit for the team?
You never actually know. You trust your gut. You think that you know. You make mistakes. And the old adage is hire slow and fire fast.
Have you had to fire fast?
Of course. I mean, every business does. Josh Coates, who's the CEO of Instructure, recently told me that you have to think of a startup like a war. That in a battle, sometimes soldiers die. You may lose the battle. You may lose lots of troops and win the battle. But ultimately, you're in this to win the war. And unfortunately, there are casualties. And sometimes the fit isn't right. Sometimes the experience isn't right. Sometimes you can't pay them what you need to pay them. And sometimes they're looking for something else in their life. All of those stars have to align. So that's really what you're looking for in hiring.
When did you know it was time to grow Blinksy's team?
So growing the company is an interesting process and a hard thing to dial in. You don't want to hire too early and you don't want to hire too late. Hiring process also takes time. Finding good people isn't easy. Everyone wants them. And usually the people worth hiring have a job or are looking at other opportunities as well. So it's something you have to keep your ear to the ground on. You've got to understand and forecast really well. You've got to have a sense of what's coming. And if you overhire, you've got to be willing to make cuts. And if you underhire, you've got to be willing to put in the hours.
How does Blinksy's diversity help improve its team?
Yeah, so diversity is, of course, an important issue for me. I was very involved in diversity issues at the university, conscious of being in Utah and sort of the challenges we have with recruiting a diverse workforce. Diversity really brings a different experience, a different view to the table. Really something we've benefited from. Ideas that have popped up from different experiences that people have had, different paths they've taken in life, and how those all combine to build their experience and their worldview.
So coming together as a team, it just makes you that much more stronger.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think about your own identity, that you identify as a gay male. So much of your involvement as a leader on the University of Utah campus through ASUU dealt a lot with diversity initiatives. And no doubt it's formed you to be a leader who is not only involved in growing Blinksy as a company, but also involved creating a diverse team.
Yeah, I mean, look, diversity for me is different than I think diversity for many people. I see it all as an opportunity. I look for the diversity in everyone. I don't believe that you aren't diverse because you're a white male. I believe that there are facets of everyone's background that bring diversity and experience to the team. So that's what I try to encourage, and that's what I focus on. My sexual orientation wasn't really a driving force in most of that. I think primarily it was my experience overseas. The military is a very good blend of racial, cultural, and social identities, a place where people get to experience different things in different ways. But to be honest, kind of a socialist place too, where everyone's sort of making the same incomes, socializing in the same ways, doing the same things, and getting the same treatment because you're all in the same sort of rank, if you will. So I was fortunate enough to experience that and see that as a model. And that's what I wanted to focus on in diversity for myself and for the business. I wanted ideas and thoughts to come together to help us to all succeed. And I wanted to make sure that everyone here could empathize with someone else, regardless of what situation they're in, what background they came from, or the problems they were experiencing.
As of February 2016, Blinksy was working with the Utah State Legislature on a bill called the Data Privacy Best Practices Act, House Bill 369. What is the current progress of this bill?
So we were fortunate to report that the legislature passed HB 369 at the last legislative session, in large part due to the valiant efforts of UDOT and UDOT's executive leadership team. We were fortunate to be a business sponsor and work with them on this very important initiative, which essentially set out a standard that the data that we collect and other companies like us can collect that assists the public, that assists in traffic management purposes and planning purposes, and provide this massive public and social good, should not be used against people, should not be used to investigate crimes, and really to make both our customers and, of course, the public feel comfortable that data and technology can go hand in hand with data and privacy security concerns, and that we're on the forefront of those issues. We're very happy to report that the Utah State Legislature took the courageous step of being a pioneer and a leader on this front across the country.
What duty do you feel private enterprises and big data like Blinksy have to the people it uses its data from? And how does that inform how you aggregate data as a company?
Yeah, look, these policies are important not just from a altruistic social good perspective, but also they make business sense. So I think the business community has an obligation for many reasons. One, they have an obligation to their shareholders to make sure that they are not in a PR scandal because of something dumb they've done. But they, of course, have a responsibility to the public and to the people, both to their employees and to the general population. We, in particular, serve public institutions, and I believe that it's our purpose and mission to ensure that we're acting in their best interests and also that we're providing value to them far above and beyond the value they could get anywhere else. That everyone sees us as a leader, as a pioneer, as someone they want to work with.
What opportunities do you foresee that government will exploit with regards to big data in the future?
Government is on the verge of a data revolution. I think in large part data like what we collect will be used to inform everything from traffic light synchronization to emergency response. It will be used for better planning. It will be used for infrastructure improvement. It will be used to make better decisions and to more effectively manage tax expenditures and revenue generation. Government is about to morph into something more akin to the private sector because of the data and the technology tools that are becoming available to it.
What do you find most exciting about big data within the current marketplace, looking ahead for the next year?
Change, of course, is the biggest opportunity. It's exciting and interesting to see and think about what's going to happen next, to see the impact on people's lives and the opportunity for change. How many lives can be saved if traffic lights sync in a different way, or if they are managed in a different way so that emergency responders don't have to barrel through an intersection with a green light and get T-boned in the intersection. The opportunity for smog and emissions reductions are phenomenal. I mean, really, the world is going to change because of technology.
If you could talk to a younger version of yourself, perhaps a freshman in undergrad, Mark Pittman, what would you give him for advice?
One, learn to code. I come back to that a lot. And two, I think I would encourage myself, or looking back, I said, look, everything that you're doing will lead to something. I always felt very secure in that, but having that reassurance would have made it even easier. I mean, the entrepreneurial path is a fairly lonely one. It's fairly difficult. At times, people who you think would support you or are supportive of you don't feel very supportive. It's important that both my former me and that other future entrepreneurs realize that it's going to be a tough journey and they're just going to have to buck up.
Well, thank you so much, Mark, for meeting with me to talk on You, LaSalle Student Entrepreneur.
Thanks.
You can find out more about Blinksy at www.blynccsy.com and more about entrepreneurship at lassonde.utah.edu. I'm Jay Abubo, and thanks for listening. Remember, entrepreneurs, be resilient and stay goals.